At the beginning of the last century, former USDA Secretary of Agriculture F.H. King studied the agriculture of China, Korea, and Japan. He then came home and wrote Farmers of 40 Centuries, which today leads us to ask, how can we farm for 40 centuries?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with your host, Michael Olson. And now get ready for 1 hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Hello out there. You are tuned into the 1165th edition of the Food Chain right here on the GCN Radio Network. Hey, perhaps you're our friends, among our friends down there in La Paz, who are tuned in as we stream along in the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio. Folks, 218 years ago, former Secretary of United States Department of Agriculture F.H. King took the best ag technology the modern West had to offer to Asia to do a little comparison shopping. The essence of what he learned can be gleaned from observations recorded in his book, Farmers of 40 Centuries. Give a listen, a careful listen. The man walking down the row with his manure pail swinging from his shoulders informed us on his return that in his household there were 20 to be fed, that from his garden of half an acre, he usually sold produce bringing in $400. Now, folks, that $400 in today's dollars would be roughly $6,000. The crop was cucumbers in groups of two rows 30 inches apart in the row. King then goes on to explain how this Chinese farmer's technology, which was the result of 4,000 years of survival of the fittest farming, how it worked. He then offered this conclusion. 4 acres of cucumbers handled by American field methods would not yield more than this man's half acre. And he grows besides 2 other crops the same season. The difference is not so much in activity of muscle as it is in alertness and efficiency of the gray matter of the brain. Think about that for just a moment. This farmer of 40 centuries, using little more than his mind and muscle, was 800% more productive than the best of the West. Now, the thought comes to my mind is something like this. Can we combine the best of traditional agriculture with the best of modern agriculture to create the means to carry us on for another 40 centuries? Who better to ask than my friend David Bloom, who is the farmer at Whiskey Hill Farm in Freedom, California, the author of Alcohol Can Be a Gas, and the proprietor of Bloom Distillation. David, welcome back to the Food Chain.
Well, always glad to be here, Michael.
Been a while. Last time we were talking about alcohol, and we were looking at the prospects of a new technology called cellulosic ethanol, but it doesn't seem to have worked out.
Well, yes, of course, and I'd like to point out that although people notice that I make alcohol, I'm an alcohol professional, not a professional alcoholic. So cellulosic ethanol. Well, you know, we all know about making alcohol from grain. I mean, that's beer or whiskey, you know, depending on what stage of the process. But can we make it out of wood fiber? Technically, it should be possible because wood fiber is nothing but a lot of sugar all chained together.
Really tightly.
Very, very tightly. And so, you know, we should be able to make alcohol from it because we do start with sugar. Mm-hmm. So, and if it happens to be kind of glued together as starch, like we find in grain, well, we can find natural enzymes that reduce that 30 or 40 sugar molecules down to individual molecules, and we feed them to yeast.
Away we go.
And then, of course, yeast make the alcohol, you know, or they make what we use to rise bread, carbon dioxide. Right. Well, it all seems simple enough, but cellulose is a chain 10,000 units long, and then the chains are joined side to side by other connections. And so that's why you have cotton thread, which is pure cellulose. And it's strong.
Very strong, yeah.
And, you know, of course, if this was a wooden desk, I'd say, can you turn that into alcohol? And you would say, it looks pretty tough. And it is really tough. But if you focus all the research of all the universities on trying to answer that question, can we make alcohol from cellulose? You don't ask any other questions like, well, what if we use something that really worked? Right. And so you got to wonder if where we allocate our research dollars is really in the search of curiosity and answers, or is it like to divert us from what might really work, because people are pretty happy with the way they make money now.
So in essence, cellulosic could work if we could come up with the right enzymes. But the thought that, you know, if we do come up with the right enzymes, and that enzymes happen to get loose, it could eat everything.
Well, Dr. Elaine Ingham, who you've probably even interviewed on the show, an expert in what goes on in the soil, tells a story about a lab that was investigating just that. Somebody had worked on a bacteria that could actually eat cellulose and make alcohol. And it wasn't very efficient, you know, and it would never be cost effective, but the lab, you know, the grad students in the lab threw it out the back door when they were done with the experiment, right next to the little stairs coming into the place. And they started noticing that nothing grew there. And one of the lab guys said, no, it couldn't be, you know. And so he took a sample from the soil and found out that this Klebsiella bacteria, which is often known as a leaf burner, it just eats the leaves that fall on the forest floor, was still alive, which,
Oh, here we go.
And plant roots, when they're very, very tiny, are pure cellulose. And so here it was, Klebsiella was eating that cellulose. If that bacteria had gotten loose all over the planet, it would have ended plant life and therefore food and therefore us. So, gene splicers, I'm sure they're perfectly nice people, but we really need to lock them all up and keep them away from labs because they're not ecologists. They don't think of the consequences.
Right. You know, all they're thinking about really is if I do A and to B and I get a C, then everything is fine. But they don't think about all the rest of the alphabet possibilities that could happen.
Well, we're talking about what's the best technology combined with the oldest technology, and we have to be careful when we go to do that. So in this valley here, strawberries are king, and a company called Calgene was asked to make better strawberries.
Of course.
And the better strawberries had to do with, would they resist frost, you know, which shortens the season at the front and back by a couple of weeks in each side. And the strawberry guy said, we want those weeks of production.
Because that's where the money is.
And that's where the money is. As you know, Michael, early and late is when you get the premium. You know, in fact, this week I'm getting about 40% more for turmeric than I'm going to get in about a month because I'm a little early compared to everyone else. So that market force had the strawberry growers go to a company called Calgene over in Berkeley and say, figure out how we resist frost. And they looked at this bacteria that was on the leaf of the strawberry, which is called Pseudomonas syringii. Well, syringe, it's got a little point, right?
Right.
So this bacteria sits on the leaves, and bacteria wants to eat sugar. The leaves have sugar, but it's dry. How do you absorb sugar when you're a bacteria? So this bacteria was very clever by making that spike, because water or ice would condense on it and then melt.
Mm.
The water would drench the bacteria, it would dissolve the sugar, and lo and behold, the bacteria gets to eat. So, and it is that sharp point that made the water or the ice condense into the damage that was causing the strawberry. So they said, well, we'll just make this bacteria with a dull point, and then it won't condense the water, and everybody will be happy. And they succeeded doing that. The problem is that bacteria in nature blows up into the clouds, and on the point of that bacteria, water condenses and becomes rain. So Calgene wanted to release this for trials.
Oh, my goodness.
And we stopped it not because of that problem, which would have ended rain all over the planet, but because it stopped frost from forming on pigweed. And pigweed, amaranth species, you know, has a root that goes all the way to China, and seeds that are like smoke, they're so tiny. And so farmers sued to not let this stuff be released because the only good thing about pigweed is frost killed it. So wow. This would have made the superweed. So this is ecology, where we ask the bigger question, not can we stop frost on strawberries, but what would happen if we did that?
How does all of this fit together? Folks, this is the Food Chain Radio Program. Michael Olson. Today we're going to have a lot of fun talking with David Bloom. And we're going to look about combining the technologies of traditional agriculture with that of modern technology to synthesize a technology that will carry us for another 40 centuries. Food Chain Radio, right back. Do stay tuned.
We're on the farm with Joel Salatin.
Would you like to buy homemade soup, backyard chicken, and the neighbor's artisanal lunch meat? The Farm to Consumer Legal Defense Fund protects your right to acquire the food of your choice from the source of your choice. I'm Joel Salatin from Polyface Farm, and I urge you to defend the right of neighbors to engage in direct food commerce. Join today at farmtoconsumer.org. The food of your choice from the source of your choice. That's farmtoconsumer.org. Farmtoconsumer.org. Thank you.
When you buy local American-grown flowers, flowers will grow and flourish in America. Hello, I'm Deborah Prinzing, author of Slow Flowers for Certified American-Grown Flowers. When you buy local flowers, you're helping our country's family farms reduce the transportation footprint of flowers and enjoy fresher, longer-lasting bouquets. So please, next time you shop for flowers, think local. Think Certified American-Grown Flowers. Visit AmericanGrownFlowers.org to learn more.
You can dream it, build it, own it, Metro Farm it. You can sow it, feed it, grow it, Metro Farm it. You can harvest it and dry it. You can sell it, Metro Farm it.
Learn how to dream it, build it, sow it, seed it, grow it, harvest it, sell it, Metro Farm it. Yes, you can do it. Dream it, build it, earn it, own it, Metro Farm it.
Oh, learn it, do it, earn it, Metro Farm it. Dream it, build it, own it, it's easy, you can do it, Metro Farm it.
It's all in Metro Farm, the guide to growing for the city. Get your copy today at metrofarm.com.
It's easy, you can do it, Metro Farm it.
And now, back to What's Eating What on the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Well, F.H. King in the year 1900 went to the Far East, Asia, Korea, Japan, looked at the technologies of how they went about doing things. You know, when we look at them, we see a guy walking down the road with a manure pail swinging and think, oh, how ridiculous. But you know, folks, that technology that they learned through 4,000 years of survival of the fittest agriculture taught them a lot about how to get the most from the least and not how to waste anything. So that's where we're going today in modern times with David Bloom. And today we're going to talk about Whiskey Hill Farm, a turmeric farm in Freedom, California. David, you bought the place, and everything was perfect and ready to go. Not right.
Well, no, it had been a flower farm for a couple of decades before I bought it. And whenever you grow a crop, the longer it's in the ground, the more chances something will attack it. So flowers, they stay in the ground the longest because you wait till they flower.
Yeah.
So flower farmers have to use, if they're chemical type, conventional farmers.
Modern farmers.
That's right. Modern technology farmers. They have to use many, many things to control damage, because not only for the food quality, but for the appearance, because right. That's what flowers are for. So they use, you know, pesticides, herbicides.
Fungicides.
Like fungicides, rodenticides. Can't have those rats eating it. you know, miticides, because they can make little damages to the flower, and goes on and on. So the soil was completely sterile.
So decades of modern technology, and when you bought the farm, you had not much left in the soil. How much life was left in the soil?
Well, a lot of times we measure that by how much organic matter is there, because all the little creatures...
Which is life.
Well, yes. Right. It's what feeds all the little creatures, microscopic creatures, and it was less than 1%. Now, we farmers think that soil is dead if it has less than 2% organic matter, because there's not enough to feed the whole right. food chain. So I'm up to 15% now, which is pretty close to what a forest soil is. And in the result of doing that work of increasing the soil carbon, I now get record crops in only 2 years after the surface of the moon, which is what my farm was like when I got it.
Well, how did you go about doing that? What was your first step? I mean, you start with death, and how do you bring life to that?
There's a couple of ways. One is, well, the first thing is you have to have food for the organisms. So I found when I was driving around the county, where we have a lot of forest here and all that, and there's a lot of tree trimming going on. Well, I'd stop by a truck that was chipping, you know, what they had cut that day, and it said, hey, instead of going to the dump, here's $10. Come to my farm and dump the chips here. You know, it's beer money. It'd be great, you know. So word got around to all the different chip companies. I'm having a parade of trimmer chip companies coming and dumping wood chips at my place, which is, you know, pure organic matter. Mm-hmm. So we ground it up a little bit and we put it underground. And we didn't have any opportunity to compost it or anything first. But as we put it underground, well, we sprayed it with a nice collection of good bacteria and fungi. And since they were on the food itself, they were in the soil, they grew and they spread through the soil. And all that life is what made our fertility. So when, a little creature like, a nematode goes ahead and eats some fungus that's growing on that piece of wood and poops it out, well, there's the manure. Instead of the manure bucket going down the road, I have the manure being made in the soil by things too small to see.
So essentially, the only difference between you and that farmer of 40 centuries is that the farmer of 40 centuries was carrying the nutrients in buckets that he got night soil.
Yeah.
And you were having the bugs do the work for you.
Yeah, because, you know, one of the things we all know from the farmers of 40 centuries is that the thing that you have the least amount of on a farm is extra time. So, you know, time is our most valuable resource. And so anything we can do to avoid extra work, we do. So if I can get the little creatures in the soil to do all the work instead of my carrying the fertilizer or spreading the compost out in the field, that's better. Now, I'm not against work. I'm just against extra work.
So, for step number one, you have to bring life back to the soil. You had to take what modern agriculture science destroyed and bring life to it, back to it, using that traditional technology of the farmer of 40 centuries.
That's right. And although the farmer of 40 centuries couldn't see the bacteria,
and probably didn't even know about it, right?
And didn't even know they existed. He knew something was in the manure that worked. Oh. So the difference between then and now is we have names for the things that he did by instinct.
Okay, so you have life in your soil and everything's starting to smile in the soil. Now you're growing turmeric.
Yes.
Turmeric or turmeric?
Turmeric, yes.
Turmeric.
There's an R in there.
Okay. Turmeric. Why?
Well, you know, farmers are always, if they're not stuck in the mud farmers, which there's a lot of those, but ones that think ahead to say, how can I do things a little better and make a little more money? Well, we look at what's becoming popular, and turmeric, oh my, is becoming very popular because it replaces 14 major drugs that we, most of us take. blood pressure, heart medication, anti-inflammatories. Well, for over 2,000 years, people in India have been using turmeric for all those things.
And that's why their food is yellow.
Yes, the color in mustard comes from turmeric, for instance. Now, I was at my health center, Kaiser, not too long ago, and I heard the nurse talking to an elderly woman. And she said, you need to take turmeric every day for your arthritis because the drugs we have don't do as good a job as turmeric. And here I am in a major health system, and they're advocating for it. Yeah. So I walk up to the nurse and the patient, and I say, well, I happen to be the largest grower of organic turmeric in North America. And everyone in the office looked up, and they all crowded around to find out where our farm was and what we did and all that. Because the word is out that this particular thing is really popular now. And so that's the best time to be in on growing a crop when the demand is greater than supply.
Yes, but it's a tropical plant, turmeric.
Well, that's right.
And we're not tropical. I mean, we're kind of Mediterranean, but not tropical.
No, tropical means no frost. That's the key definition. It also means warm, but mainly no frost. And so... well, why did I have the ability to do it? Well, the farm I bought was a flower farm, which meant they had 5 acres of glass greenhouses. So I looked at that and said, let's see, I have a surplus of heat here. How do I use that surplus of heat, that solar heat, to raise a crop that no one else around here can because they don't have that surplus of heat? And so there's a few things that I came up with, horned melons and monk fruit and all this stuff, but also turmeric, and turmeric is the one I focus on, and ginger.
And ginger. Wow. Two of my favorites right there. Okay, so here you are. You have crops growing, and but that's not all you do.
Oh, no. No, I mean, part of what we do is look at how we can help improve farming around the world and even off this world. So NASA came to see me at my farm because they want to grow food on Mars, because taking food to Mars costs $1,000 a gram. So it makes sense to grow it there. And after going through our greenhouse, they said, we'd have to spend $1 billion to get to where you are today with your research. We'd like to make you the first farmer of Mars. And I said, fine, but I always get a site visit before I do a consultation.
Okay, folks, this is the Food Chain Radio Program. Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio. What's Eating What today is, how do we go about providing ourselves with the means to grow food for the next 4,000 years, 40 more centuries we're looking at? Can we take the best of the old and combine it with the best to do of the new to get to where we need to be with our technology? David Bloom is our guest, and if you stay tuned, we would start talking about how he combines some distillation into the process of growing food. Right back.
Let's go back for more of What's Eating What on the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Welcome back, folks. This is the Food Chain Radio Program. Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio. David Bloom, farmer at Whiskey Hill Farm in Freedom, California, author of Alcohol Can Be a Gas, and proprietor of Bloom Distillation. Had the opportunity to visit yesterday Whiskey Hill Farm and Bloom Distillation. And it's quite an amazing operation because it's kind of two things going on there. One is that you're farming, and the other thing is that you're distilling. Now, I've never seen a distillery at a farm. Is that something new?
Oh, no, Michael, but usually the distillery was hidden off in the woods somewhere. Even though it was on the farm, you
which
didn't
is why,
see it.
Which is why your area was known as Whiskey Hill.
Right? That's right. It was a place where moonshining happened all the way through Prohibition, and then it became legal after that.
So what did farmers do with the distillery other than make an extra money, you know, making whiskey?
Well, you know, drugs are always worth more money than raw food. Mm-hmm. I mean, look at the farmers. Value added or not quite legal, so premium price. Out in the Midwest, you can have 1,000 acres of corn, but if you happen to grow a little patch of marijuana in the middle, no one would notice, mm-hmm. right? So, but in the old days, you know, basically it was moonshine. And before it was illegal to have moonshine, farmers in Pennsylvania, which was a two-week ride away from Boston back in the day, would figure out that you could only put a certain number of sacks of corn on the back of a horse to bring it to Boston and sell it. But you could put two small kegs of whiskey on the back of the horse and make 50 times the money. So it was worth producing the value-added farm product, meaning 80-proof alcohol or 40% alcohol, and sell it to the bars in Boston. And that's where that word pony keg comes from, which is the small kegs, because a full-size keg of 50 gallons or so wouldn't work on the back of a horse. So anyway, farmers have always known that you want to go ahead and do something with your crop to make it more valuable. Now, moonshine was a good thing. And actually, before the country actually had a constitution, it took us 12 years to write a constitution here. Well, we had bills, the Revolutionary War bills. Oh. And we had to pay for all those weapons we bought from the other countries. And so Congress passed an excise tax on alcohol because, well, the wealthy landowners didn't want a property tax. And so they put it on the back of the farmers because the excise tax penalized the price of alcohol made from corn. Well, we'd just been through a Revolutionary War, and the farmer said, not us. We're not paying your bills.
And Tea Party, right?
No, the Tea Party were merchants. The farmers said to George Washington, who wasn't president yet, he was just a general, said, we're not gonna pay this tax. You guys just got us out of paying taxes to England. We're not going to pay tax to you. So Washington drafted 20,000 people, involuntary, you know, service in the military to go out and put down the farmers in Pennsylvania.
Wow.
And that was known as the Whiskey Rebellion, which we vaguely remember from our American history. Mm-hmm. And basically, Washington used the draft in the United States to put down American citizens, not a foreign power. And, well, you know, some things never change. George Washington was the biggest distiller in the United States.
Right.
He could pay the tax, but all the little guys couldn't. So it rubbed out his competition, and he got to benefit from his running the federal legal system. So
there you go. Some things never change, and that's one of them.
And farmers are always at the bottom of the pile making a raw material for someone else. Unless we go ahead and, you know,
Take arms and develop the technology to do it ourselves.
Right, which was distillation. And in the modern era, farmers make alcohol to run our cars. We make 16 billion gallons of alcohol in the United States.
From crop residues.
And from crops and from corn, which we only take the starch out of the corn and we make alcohol with it to run our cars. You know, we call it E85 or 85% alcohol. But even our alcohol in our fuel in California is 15% alcohol to make our emissions cleaner.
Now, when I was at Bloom Distillery yesterday, your vice president, Tom, showed me, gave me a little demonstration. He took two little glass saucers and put gasoline in one and alcohol in the other and lit them both afire.
Yes.
Now, the gasoline fire, you know, it flamed up maybe 8 inches.
Yep.
And smoked. Just a lot of smoke. And the alcohol fire, you could barely see it.
Yes.
I mean, you really had to look to see the fire. And when both of them burned out, well, first of all, I wondered about, it looked like there was a lot more energy in the gasoline than the alcohol. Is that true?
Well, there is if you look at how much heat you can get out of the fuel if you burn it perfectly. But that doesn't exist in the real world.
Okay.
So basically, gasoline is made of carbon and hydrogen. It's a hydrocarbon. Alcohol is made from hydrogen and carbon, but also oxygen. So when you burn the two, that oxygen built into alcohol makes a perfect combustion. So you get 99% less emissions from your tailpipe running on pure alcohol.
And when the fires were out,
yes,
you could look at the dishes that they were burned in. The one that contained the gasoline was pure black.
That's right.
Covered in black.
Yes.
And the one that had burned the alcohol, you couldn't see anything in it.
Yes, when we have Chinese visitors come to our farm, we point to the two dishes and we say, the one that's all black, that's your lungs in Beijing. And the one that's clear, that's your lungs in Santa Cruz. Because all that soot going into the atmosphere from our cars and from wherever we burn fuel, well, we're, you know, as human beings, really handy to filter that out of the air with our lungs.
So this is really interesting. Here we have those farmers of 40 centuries coming to here to Freedom, California, and looking at this distillation technology, and they're probably thinking, how can we marry this technology with our farmers of 40 centuries technology?
Absolutely. So farming in China is done on basically an acre or two or so.
Right.
It's all small farms, and you know, all that produce basically is comes together and then makes a market. But how do you go ahead and bring Western agriculture to China? Well, you can't do it because you don't have big swaths of land.
Hey, that's
that
what F.H. King found. You know, he looked at how on just a half an acre of land, but why goodness, our tractors wouldn't even turn around.
Practically.
So what we do here with our vast amounts of space cannot be done there.
Unless you get all the farmers to get off the land, congregate the land so Western corporations can farm it. And when I know you're signaling me that we're ending up, so when we come back, we can say exactly how those small farmers can compete with American agriculture.
And is that not what we're looking for? This is the Food Chain Radio Program. Michael Olson, of course, today we've got David Bloom, Whiskey Hill Farms in Freedom, California. Alcohol can be a gas. Saw it yesterday. Looked beautiful. And also Bloom Distillation. Maybe we can make these things and get them all over the world. So stay tuned. When we come back, we're going to learn about how this distillation technology can be used to benefit small farmers like those that farm for the city. This is the Food Chain, right back to stay tuned.
And now, more of What's Eating What on the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Okay, David, you teased us and now we're ready. How on earth can this distillation technology that you're demonstrating to the Chinese benefit small farmers?
Well, you know, we can look at a model in America, which was tobacco farming. Every farmer had a little patch of tobacco they were allocated to grow for a tobacco company. And they'd make many times the money per square foot on that little patch of tobacco as they would growing corn or everything else for the market. So, and that kept farms alive, that you know, high margin, you know, high value product. Remember, drugs are good money.
They're drugs, yeah.
So
especially illegal ones.
Or legal ones like tobacco.
The harder you make it, the more money there is in it, right?
Actually, it's pretty easy for me to make money with those things, but I'll let that slide. So the small farmer in China, if we go to each small farmer in, like, say, a 5-mile radius around a town, and we say, tell you what, you have 2 acres there, we'll go ahead and give you an allocation of half an acre of energy crop. It could be sugar beets or sorghum or any number of things. And so we'll give you that allocation, and we're going to pay you a good price for that because we're going to be able to make a lot of money on it. So they can still grow their bok choy and Napa cabbage and all the other stuff
for the market. Vegetables or whatever, yeah.
But their cash crop that pays the real nut of the property would be from the alcohol. So that's kind of like what farmers did here with alcohol. In other words, Gene Lodgston writes about this in the Midwest, where farmers would grow corn and would pay the bills, but to pay the note on the property, you had to make some moonshine and sell that for more money. So we're using farmers' strategies, and we're saying, let's adapt it to China, where we put in a community plant, and every farmer brings their energy crop into the plant, and they get paid well for that, and that takes care of the hard floor of keeping the economics of the farm going. Now, American farmers growing corn, well, it's just almost as bad. Corn is very unprofitable to grow. You're looking at an average net income of 1-2% over time. Any given year, you'll lose money. And 1 out of 4, well, the price of corn is up and you make money. It's a pretty tough row to hoe, as we say in farming. So if we're making the corn into alcohol, we're only making the starch into alcohol, we sell that off, and that's worth a lot of money. But we haven't lost the value of the corn as animal feed, which is why we grow corn. 90% of the corn is fed to animals. The protein and fat that were in that corn are still there. We call that distiller's grains. And that's worth a lot more money than corn by itself, because cows cannot digest starch.
So you're making it easier for the cattle to eat and digest, and you're getting an extra product.
And a little more meat, because all that indigestible starch is not interfering with the digestion of the cow. So it's not food versus fuel. It's more food and fuel.
And fuel.
If we take the starch out of the way.
Okay. What do we do with the alcohol besides drink it?
Well, in the United States, we use it for cars. You know, alcohol is in the fuel all over the country, but not as much as we could put in our cars.
Now, 85%?
No, actually, most fuel in the United States has 10% or 15% alcohol in it.
So it's a little bit.
Yeah, and it's put in there because we have to clean up the air, and alcohol does that. Alcohol by itself is 99% pollution-free, as you pointed out, Michael.
I saw it myself. Absolutely. It's clean as a whistle.
And you put that in gasoline, it helps clean up some of the toxic yuck from gasoline. So basically, if we...
It probably doesn't even stink.
It doesn't. You can't smell it, you know, unlike what comes out of the tailpipe of everything else. Now, with alcohol and fuel injection, which is the kind of system we have nowadays for mixing the air and fuel in our cars, we have a computer that's pretty smart that adjusts for different things. And we can run 30% alcohol in every car on the road today with zero, and I repeat, zero modifications.
Wow. Now, can we get enough alcohol to supply that demand?
Well, we already are supplying 10%. Getting up to 30% would seem pretty darn easy. And we're only using a tiny fraction of our corn land for that, only 70 or 80 million acres. And we basically have 1.5 billion acres of viable farmland in the United States, most of which we don't grow anything on other than grass for cows because we don't have a market for it.
There you go. Now, if we were to take marginal farmland, for example, and grow corn for fuel, could we then recycle a lot of that life back into the soil and rebuild the soil, regenerate the soil?
Well, I think that should be the basic program. So let's say instead of corn this year, because we don't want to overflood the market with corn, because as we all know, as farmers, that means the price goes to zero and we all lose money. So let's say we shift our land to a couple of other crops in rotation, which is good for the soil. Let's say sugar beets, let's say sorghum, even Jerusalem artichokes, those tuberous things. Now, the way that would work is now we keep corn in the right proportion of the mix, and we're able to keep the price up without having to pay subsidies. What we're doing is giving farmers the ability to grow multiple crops and get paid well to bring those crops to make food for animals and fuel for our cars. But the fact that 30% of the fuel in cars can be added at no change to the car, well, we import 30% of our oil from Arabia. Wouldn't it be nice if the farmers grew that 30% and we didn't have to send our military to Arabia to try to protect the oil lanes?
Okay, when we get back, can we take the best of that old technology, combine it with the best of the new for 40 more centuries? Right back.
So much to say, so little time to say it, on The Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Well, have a lot of problems looking into the future, but can we pull ourselves together, find solutions for them? Let's talk about one giant problem, the amount of food we waste, the amount of food we throw away. Got any ideas, David?
Well, actually, I have a few. Basically, what I like to say is there's no requirement for us to keep doing things stupidly. You know, we do have an option to do things in a better way. So I've made alcohol out of all kinds of things, like donuts, you know.
Candy.
Well, cops can only eat so many donuts and the rest go to waste. Waste candy, which is a lot of. I've done it with almond hulls and grape pulp and apple pulp.
I tasted some strawberry yesterday.
Oh, no, you didn't. No, that wasn't a beverage. That you smelled strawberry.
I smelled it.
That's right. You didn't taste it. So basically, yes, we can make alcohol out of all these things. Now, you know, in most cases, like in the case of strawberries, where that's the big thing here, 25 to 30% of all strawberries don't make it into the basket. They're not pretty enough, they're slightly not ripe, and they just throw them in the path. If we turn those strawberries into alcohol, we'd have millions of gallons of alcohol just from the waste of that one crop. And then you look at all the waste of food on the way through the chain by the time it gets to the supermarket, and it's another 25, 30% food waste right at the processing level, and then in the transfer between all the different brokers. So,
and then after it's cooked and whatnot too, the stuff that restaurants throw out.
Yeah, and in some cities now we're taking the food waste and it goes into a separate can where it gets used to make compost, which is a perfectly respectable idea. But we could make alcohol from it first and then take the byproduct from that.
And put it into the compost.
Correct. So when we're looking at that, I've looked at a list of 20,000 food processing plants in the United States that all have enough waste to support an alcohol plant. Mm-hmm. And that waste currently goes into landfills where, when you bury it, it makes methane.
Which is bad.
It's really a bad...
Bad gas.
It is. And it is 60 times worse than carbon dioxide for the environment, you know, for climate change. Mm-hmm. So many jurisdictions, including California, are banning the burying of food processing waste in the landfill, and counties are freaking out because they pay the fines. And so counties are asking us, hey, can you put an alcohol plant here, intercept the peach waste or the raisin waste or the whatever waste, make alcohol so that we don't put it in the landfill, and we dodge the bullet on those fines.
And just like those farmers of 40 centuries where nothing goes to waste, where everything is used and it becomes beneficial instead of garbage. That is what we're looking for.
Well,
David Bloom, it seems to me like you're having way too much fun.
Well,
how do
yes.
we get in touch with you?
Well, to find me, it's pretty simple. I've been doing this a while. You can find me at permaculture.com, like permanent agriculture. And that's from the educational side of what I do. And then you can find me at Bloom, B-L-U-M-E, distillation.com if you want to know more about the alcohol side of things.
And check it out, folks. You'll have a lot of fun. This has been The Food Chain. Thank you all for tuning in. Remember, Michael Olson's first law of the food chain, agriculture, the foundation upon which we build all our sandcastles. Thanks, Dave.
Thank you, Michael.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with Michael Olson. And if your friends missed the show, tell them to log on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com for a listen. Now, go out and find some food with its farmer's face on it and live.